The Word of Mouth podcast from NHPR is made possible with support from you, our subscribers.
And from Dartmouth Hitchcock, offering care in 30 locations across northern New England and in your community. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here. Dartmouth-Hitchcock.org.
And from Heinemann, a provider of resources written by real teachers for real classrooms. Heinemann values teachers as decision makers and students as curious learners. Discover the path to lifelong professional learning at Heinemann.com. Heinemann, dedicated to teachers.
I'm Virginia Prescott, and this is Word of Mouth, your questions answered, your state explored. And today we are revisiting and updating the Only in New Hampshire stories that got a lot of attention over the past couple months, and checking in on some of the feedback you've given us about those stories, good and bad. Joining me in the studio is senior producer Taylor Quimby. Hey, Taylor.
Hello.
And we're starting off with one of the most popular shared talked about stories we've had on the show in a very long time, the story of the chicken farmer rock.
Which, you know, I've only ever seen in the pictures. I've never actually driven by it.
I've been there. I've seen it. I've touched it. I've photographed it.
I can't tell how big it is from the photos.
You know, it's one of those things that seems monumental and is surprisingly small.
Yeah.
So give us a recap on this story.
Well, the chicken farmer rock is a very famous rock on Route 103 up in Newberry. And just as a way of intro, the producer who did this story, Paige Sutherland, is a reporter here at NHPR. She's usually covering very serious stuff, like the opioid crisis, news from the State House, that kind of thing. So I think it was a real change for her to investigate this mysterious bit of graffiti. This is part of our Only in New Hampshire series. She'll get into that, so I'll let the mystery go from there.
All right, let's hear the story and the other side of Paige Sutherland.
Every summer, Kelsey McNaught and her family take a trip up to Lake Sunapee. And every time they do, they play this little game.
When we pass the sign, we all scream, "Chicken Farmer, I still love you!"
Kelsey's always wondered, who wrote this message? Who was it for? And why a chicken farmer?
Why not a firefighter? Why not a regular farmer? Why not, like, a stone farmer? I don't know.
Kelsey's 28, and over the years, she's crafted her own story behind this. Man falls in love with a chicken farmer, and then declares his love on the rock. Her 9-year-old son had a slightly different idea about it when he was younger.
He honestly thought that it was a man or a woman proclaiming their love for chickens. We've corrected him, obviously, but I still like to think that somebody loved chickens so much that they decided to, like, paint their love on the side of a rock in the middle of nowhere.
But Kelsey wants to know the real story, so she asked NHPR to investigate. And that's where I come in. Being a journalist for a few years now, mainly covering drugs and politics, I thought getting to the bottom of some rock graffiti, piece of cake. Not so much. After doing some research and making a few calls, I didn't really get anywhere. So I decided to jump in my car and head right to the source.
Driving through downtown Newberry right now, I have not seen the chicken farmer rock yet. So I think I'm just going to have to pop in maybe to the library and have them point me in the direction of the rock. Town Hall Library, right here.
How are you?
Good. My name is Paige. I work for New Hampshire Public
Library. The town librarians I spoke with, Leah McBain and Laura Pizzone, both knew about the rock. They said everyone knows about it. In fact, the original rock was simply "Chicken Farmer, I Love You." There's been a movie about it, poems written, sermons given, songs, bumper stickers, and
we have the Chicken Farmer 5K race in the summer. It's just a little Newbury town race that they name after the chicken farmer.
The town loves their rock, but some outsiders didn't share that same passion.
Somebody made a complaint. They didn't like the looks of it, and they thought that it was graffiti. So the state decided, well, we're going to clean it up.
That's Dennis Pavlik. He's been the town administrator of Newbury for more than 2 decades. The state, he says, cleaned it up by painting a big red blob over the writing.
That set the residents of town into a orbit that immediately they were distraught not to see that. And then they were distraught that they never had a chance to have voice or opinion about it. So what happened was a lot of the people got upset and they started a petition.
In a town of under 2,000 people, hundreds signed the petition. and the state agreed not to touch it again. In the midst of all this, the writing mysteriously reappeared on the rock, but with a slightly different message. It said, "Chicken farmer, I still love you." And since then, the words on the rock have stayed, even getting a fresh coat of paint by some secret admirer every few years. And yet, no one really seems to know the real story behind it. I heard versions involving a chicken farmer who went off to war, one of star-crossed lovers, one story painting the chicken farmer as a man, one as a woman, one about a mother writing it for her daughter before she left for college, and one about a veterinarian who fell in love with a chicken farmer. Some locals like Donna Maddie don't want to know the real story. They think it might kill the magic.
I'm a romantic, and I love to think of stories about why it's there.
I'm not the first person to try to get to the bottom of this. In 1997, Yankee Magazine thought they had figured out the real story behind the rock. They even called it the love story of the year. Yankee said the message was written for a girl named Gretchen Rule. She now goes by Gretchen Hamill. She lived across the street from the rock, and her family had chickens. In the 1970s, she was in high school, and according to the story, the message was written for her by a secret admirer.
I had some idea of who it might have been, but it's just nice to think that someone out there likes me enough to put that on the rock.
Gretchen never confronted that person and wouldn't tell me who she thought it was, so I kept digging. The town librarians didn't know who the secret admirer was. The longtime town administrator said he had no clue, and local town folk weren't sure either. But in all my conversations, one name kept popping up as someone who knows all the facts. So I went to find him.
On top of the house on the right. This must be it. We shall see.
This man went on to tell me that there's one true story behind the rock, and he knows it. But he's not telling anyone. He says he was sworn to secrecy. The reason you're not hearing his voice is he wanted to keep his promise and stay out of it. Still, it was proof that the truth is out there.
It's so interesting that something like a rock would have people seal up so much. I mean, now I want to even know more of this story, because why aren't people talking about it? It's just a rock.
There was one other person in town who people said might have some answers. Her name is Doris Newell. She grew up in the house adjacent to the rock and raised her kids there. She's 82 and has since moved to the senior living facility down the road.
When I was a teenager, that rock was covered with foliage, all trees all around it. And I used to sit on that rock and watch the traffic go by. When the Blue Line Express went by, I knew I better get home because supper would be ready.
Doris says she noticed the graffiti when her children were in school.
So, and it just appeared one day?
Just appeared. And they would come and renew it. It would be sort of dull in the morning or in the evening. And then by the next morning, it was all brightly painted again. I never heard anybody. Could have been anybody, but I don't know.
Another dead end. With my two best leads now crossed off the list, I didn't know what to do. So I did the most logical thing. I went to go talk to people who live near the rock. But first, I had to find it.
I see some rocks. Nope. That is not the chicken farm rock. Is it? Nope. Oh, there it is. That really sneaks up on you. Almost missed it there. With the shrubbery, you really can't see it.
I then went over to the house right across the street, the one where Gretchen Rule, the girl with the secret admirer, once lived. Lynn Long now lives there, and has since the 90s. She bought the home from Gretchen's parents, Louis and Greta. She says she knows the real story, and she was willing to spill it. So spoiler alert, If you don't want to know, block your ears. The story goes like this. Greta had a good job working for the state, and her husband Lewis was a probation officer, but had to retire early for health reasons. That didn't mean he stopped working.
He did sheep. He did Christmas trees. I think he may have done a little sugaring. There used to be a cabin here, so they rented cabins out during the summertime. I mean, it just kept going on and on and on. And it's a lot of work.
So here's Lewis, who's supposed to take it easy. And instead, he's working just as hard as he did when he worked in probation. He even decides to start raising a flock of chickens. And one day, Greta had enough. And she tears into him for taking on too much. She immediately regretted it.
Greta went out there and she painted that and said, oh, it just showed up one morning. I don't know where it came from. It just showed up. It was her apology to Lewis.
Because she was bugging him about being a chicken
farmer. Right,
and
she couldn't say anything that she was the one who did it because she worked for the state and that's in the state boundaries. And it should cost her her job.
And that's how the message got there. Chicken farmer, I love you. It was a love note, but also an apology. And from the sounds of it, their relationship was just as solid as the rock itself. Greta and Lewis were married for 65 years. Around town, people say you could just tell the two were deeply in love. As her children put it, the couple was joined at the hip. They ended up moving into a retirement home in Concord. They've both since passed. Lynn says she heard the story directly from Greta when she moved into the house, and she says they even left behind some chicken feeders too. When I told Greta and Lewis's daughter Gretchen this version of the story, she was shocked and not quite sure it's true. She says her mother never told her that. You never asked your parents?
No. It just never occurred to me that one of them would use spray paint on a rock on a highway. I would have been appalled and disappointed, quite frankly, that it wasn't to me.
This all started to make more sense. Why would a high school girl raise chickens? She didn't. And why would people be so hush-hush about something as silly as writing on a rock? Well, Greta could have lost her job, or worse, could have crushed her youngest daughter's dreams that this love rock wasn't written for her. With a story to now tell, I sat down with our listener, Kelsey McNaught, to finally share it with her.
What do you think? What's your thoughts?
That's really fascinating, and I like that story a lot more than my own story. And it's fascinating because my husband, part-time, he likes to keep bees, and I can't stand that he keeps bees. So he also does all these odd jobs, and I like that story a lot more.
Kelsey said she doesn't plan to share the story with her husband. He wants to keep the mystery of it alive. That's something I heard from quite a few people in town, including the town administrator.
But, you know, that's what the glory of this whole story is because nobody really knows. I mean, they can say they know, but we don't know that to be really true, do we? That's probably why it's a great love story, is because no one's absolutely 100% sure.
I guess that's how local legends get made. After enough time passes, the details don't seem to matter as much as the mystery. There is one thing the whole town can agree on. They don't want the rock to go away. It's their town love story. For Only in New Hampshire, I'm Paige Sutherland.
I'm Virginia Prescott, and this is Word of Mouth. Your questions answered, your state explored. Joining me in the studio is our senior producer, Taylor Quimby. Taylor, I just love that story. It's got a little mystery, it's got a little romance, and brings this question of when something once considered vandalism becomes, I don't know, oddly a kind of communal touchstone, if I can say that.
Oh, wow, that's...
Sorry.
It's pretty bad. I mean, people absolutely love this story. I think, you know, partly just because when you have something on the side of the road, people drive by it and they wonder. When we put this story out there, it got shared by a ton of people. We heard a lot of great feedback. One of the places where we saw the most response was on a Facebook posting from the New Hampshire Department of Transportation. Some people sharing memories about the rock. Crystal said, "What a story of romance. I don't, as a rule, like graffiti, but this is an exception in my books." What I was most surprised about is that a lot of people actually saw this as a story not about romance, but about government intrusion and intervention.
What, really? That's surprising to you in New Hampshire?
I just didn't realize the connection that the DOT was going to end up having. Somebody said, "It's supposed to be a free country. Wow, you people really suck," which is just terrible. I mean,
I also love that it was an opportunity for people to say, "It's about time the DOT cut brush along the roads so sun can hit the roads so you don't have to use as much salt."
Exactly. To be fair, on Facebook, you know, anything goes. So there was also a long thread of comments that devolved into an argument about the usage of commas. So, you know, we're not necessarily looking at some serious responses all the way around.
Well, given the role the Department of Transportation has played in the chicken farmer saga, and also I think that they were pretty game about this, we invited Bill Boynton. He's public information officer at the DOT onto the show. And hello, Bill.
Hello, Virginia. I must plead guilty. I posted that on our media page, on our Facebook page, and I also was the spokesman at the time of this event. So I'm fully involved here.
Well, how long have you been involved in the chicken farmer saga?
Well, I didn't know too much about that whole saga until the Monitor wrote the article that sort of had everything take off after we initially painted it over. And then, you know, when Boston media calls, you know it's got legs and it's a big story.
How does the complaint process work for something like this? So if I see spray paint on a bridge near my home, do I call the DOT? What happens?
It's really a lot simpler than it sounds. While it's easy to paint us as the bad guy here, paint being the pun intended, really, we have 90 patrol facilities, 4,600 miles. We get dozens of calls every day about everything from potholes to broken guardrail, and the local patrol facility responds. And so in this case, it probably was nothing more than somebody getting a call saying, "We got some graffiti on 103. Take some rust-colored paint and go paint it over and check it off your list." And that was obviously a lack of sensitivity to the historical significance of that rock, but that's how it all began.
Well, it gained significance. I mean, are there other examples of something that might technically be viewed as graffiti, but has a similar cultural capital as the chicken farmer rocks, so that the DOT stays clear of that?
Well, in general, graffiti is not one of our top priorities when competing with some of the critical bridge and road needs that we have. And so, quite honestly, we usually only respond in the case of a something vulgar or obscene that needs to be taken care of immediately. Everything else may be gotten to. What we've found with graffiti is it comes back almost immediately, and so it's very labor intensive to deal with it, and it's also counterproductive because who's ever doing it, you're just giving them a palate again to do it again.
Bill, I'm wondering, do you ever just wish you could put something on Facebook without it blowing up into a firestorm about government intervention?
Well, you know, it's an interesting exercise. The thing I like about social media is that you get an instant response. You can tell when something's resonating. And I saw your story posted on your website, and I said, "Hey, this is a good weekend thing. I know this will create some activity." And of course, it did. So, you know, you try to laugh off most of it unless it gets personal or obscene or anything like that. But for the most part, we just try to have fun with it and try to show our transparency. We have 1,600 employees. We're not just one entity that makes decisions about everything, and we can make mistakes just like everybody else.
Yeah, watch your commas.
Watch my commas, yes. I do a lot of the three dots.
Bill Boynton, Public Information Officer at the New Hampshire Department of Transportation, thank you so much for coming in.
Thanks, Virginia.
More of our favorite stories from the Olling in New Hampshire series are coming up after a short break. This is Word of Mouth, your questions answered, your state explored. I'm Virginia Prescott here in the studio with senior producer Taylor Quimby. Hello, Taylor.
Hello, Virginia.
So today we're looking back at the most divisive and commented upon stories over the past couple months. And as is often the case, we didn't really know what we were getting into with this one, did we?
No. You know, there's certain subjects that, like, you understand you cannot discuss without expecting fireworks, you know, guns.
Common core,
yeah. I mean, there's a million of them, you know, a lot of political stuff. But Woodsmoke didn't realize that this was going to be divisive.
Mm-hmm. Now, this came from one of the stories in our Olingen, New Hampshire series. That's where we investigate listener questions. The question we were trying to answer this time was, why does no one know or care that wood smoke is as bad for you as cigarette smoke or diesel smoke? That's what came from the listener. So to find out if it was true, and if so, why, we brought in Sam Evans Brown. He's host of Outside In. Let's hear it. Well, quick answer first. Are wood stove smoke, diesel smoke, and cigarette smoke all equally bad for you?
In fact, wood smoke might be worse for you than cigarette smoke, but that's only if you were to smoke it like you were to smoke a cigarette. And the infamous study in which this is based basically did just that. It burnt a piece of wood, burnt some tobacco, and analyzed what was inside both, the fumes coming off of both of them. And in fact, the wood smoke seemed to be worse for you than the cigarette smoke. However, you don't smoke wood like you smoke a cigarette. You burn it and you get the smoke away from you as quickly as possible. And so the health impacts of wood stoves are much fuzzier than the health impacts of cigarette smoke.
Well, let's talk about the stuff that's in them. What in particular is detrimental to the body about these varieties of smoke?
Well, there's all sorts of crazy stuff in wood smoke. I mean, with cigarettes, I'm sure you remember all the doctors who would go on TV and talk about the 7,000 chemicals that are in cigarettes. There are also a ton of chemicals in a chunk of wood, you know. And when you burn it, you get all sorts of very standard pollutants that you hear about. Nitrogen oxide, sulfur oxide, so NOx and SOx you might have heard about, which are also in power plant emissions, dioxins, formaldehyde. But to really talk about what matters, the most damaging thing that's in wood smoke that you hear about is particulate matter. And we're just talking about little tiny pieces of stuff that when you breathe it in are so small that they get way down deep into your lungs, get lodged there, and then your body has to deal with them, which you know, it can do in small doses, but gets overwhelmed very easily.
What about nicotine? That is not in wood smoke.
No, indeed not. And in fact, there's a lot of stuff that's in cigarettes that's not in wood smoke. A lot of that sort of active ingredients, the carcinogens in cigarettes, are things that when you breathe in a cigarette become gasified and are actually absorbed into your lungs, like nicotine is. The particulates, that's not what happens. They just sort of get lodged there. But nicotine isn't really bad for you in the same way that many of the other contents of cigarettes are. Nicotine is more like caffeine. It's a slightly addictive substance that makes it so that you're coming back to cigarettes over and over, and therein lies the health risk. And wood smoke does have things that are absorbed into your lungs. It's just that those aren't really the large health risk when it comes to wood smoke. We're really talking about this big dose of tiny little chunks of stuff that you get in your lungs from breathing it in.
So if you were in a not very well ventilated room, for example.
Yeah. And in fact, this is one of the things that if you're worried about, this is the first time you're hearing about this and you're worried about these health impacts, what you can do is you can try to minimize the amount of time that you smell wood smoke in your house. You know, try to light your stove really efficiently so you don't get wood smoke in the house. Try to stoke the stove less frequently so you're not opening the door as much. If you smell that smoke, that's a good indication that you're doing something bad for your lungs.
How about wood pellet stoves? Those are supposed to be so much better environmentally.
Wood pellet stoves are much cleaner burning than wood stoves. And in fact, I brought a handy dandy little visual aid for you to react to here. This shows the amount of particulate matter that is put out by the various types of things you can burn. If you look on the far left of that graph, you see a traditional fireplace. Mm-hmm. They're incredibly dirty. And in fact, the y-axis of that graph had to be manipulated.
It goes 1, 2, 3, 4, and then jumps to 28.
Just so that they can show what fireplaces do. A new wood stove is 28 times less particulate matter than that, and a pellet stove is about half of what a new wood stove puts out.
And then oil furnace, gas furnace, way down on the bottom of that axis as far as output.
And the reason for that is that they're a uniform fuel. You can control how the combustion happens, and it burns completely. And that's really what the particulates are, is they're uncombusted wood that are tiny, tiny pieces of it floating in the smoke and into your lungs.
Okay, so you said you don't smoke a wood stove, a burning piece of wood, the same way that you take in a cigarette, like suck it in. But how about what's hanging in the atmosphere? How about what is, you walk out of a house where people have been burning wood and you can actually smell wood smoke on them.
And in fact, if you're smelling wood smoke, you are getting some of that particulate matter into your lungs. And this is why organizations like the American Lung Association want to transition away from burning wood as a source of home heating. And it also gives you sort of an indication of if you want to heat with wood and want to be a little more responsible, some of the things that you can do. For instance, this time of year is a really bad time of year to burn wood because the air is warm, so the smoke comes out of the chimney. It's about the same density as the air that it hits and starts to sink back down. And you'll see this time of year where you go past a house that's burning wood and there's this sort of pall of smoke that's hanging around the house. Mm-hmm. When you get to winter, the air is colder, it's denser, and so the smoke rises up and away from the house and you're not breathing as much of it. So not burning wood in the shoulder seasons, the spring and the fall, is a good way to be a little more responsible. Also, as that graph shows you, new wood stoves are much cleaner burning than old wood stoves and way cleaner burning than fireplaces. So buying yourself a new wood stove is a way to be more responsible.
How about, you know, in industrial plants, they put scrubbers on the chimneys, right, to clean out the chemicals or to mitigate them as they're going into the atmosphere.
Yeah, well, and there's a funny thing that happens is every year there's a competition for who can build a cleaner burning wood stove that the U.S. Department of Energy puts on. And that's where catalytic converter wood stoves have come from, which you might have encountered one of those in your travels. They're the ones that you have to start them up and then you engage the catalytic converter with a lever that goes ka-chunk into place.
Haven't run into that yet. Haven't had to have that inspection done yet. But what about our listener, Evan, who phrased his question in a particular way? Why does no one care about this issue? Is there an awareness problem, Sam? Do you think he's right to phrase it that way?
Well, I think what he's responding to is that we have a culture of burning wood up here in the colder parts of the United States. Wood heat, for a lot of people, they consider it to be quote-unquote free, mm-hmm. because if the wood's coming from your property, you're cutting it yourself, you're only paying for it with your time and labor. And so it's part of the sort of Yankee identity. And I would say that there is pushback to these campaigns to get people off of wood heat. So that's what I detect in the tenor of his question is why does no one care about these public health campaigns that have been going on for decades now?
Well, there is something psychological, though, about the look of wood burning in a stove. Isn't there, you know, this sense of the hearth, especially on a cold winter day?
There's nothing more pleasant than standing next to a warm wood stove when it's cold outside. And I will confess, I heat with wood at my home. But knowing about these issues, I try to do it at times when there are going to be fewer people outside and around. I try to do it at times when the smoke's not going to hang around, and I bought myself a new, cleaner burning wood stove.
Okay, do you shift it into gear?
It's not a catalytic converter stove. It's a reburner.
Sam Evans-Brown, host of Outside In, NHPR's podcast about the natural world and how we use it. Sam, thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to Word of Mouth from NHPR. Your questions answered, your state explored. So, Taylor, what kind of reaction did we get to this story?
It was a pretty mixed bag here. Alliance for Green Heat, an advocacy organization, said, good piece of journalism, but they also thought that pellet stoves are quite a few times cleaner than the lab emissions studies that Sam pointed towards. A few folks on our website commented that pellet stoves are only reducing the problem of pollution, and so they thought our story was very pro-wood stove.
So depends on who's listening.
Yes. And then we got a zillion Facebook comments. Patricia on Facebook said that the whole interview seemed obvious. And then there's a few people that really dug into this philosophical aesthetic question that the piece poses. Dan on Facebook said, I will gladly trade the good times and memories for whatever smoke I might inadvertently inhale from the fire. Thank you very much. Crystal said, my friends hate me for not sitting around the fire pit with them. I have asthma. And she says she has two fireplaces herself, but one is gas and the other is electric.
And that last comment really got us thinking. When I talked to Sam for this story, we completely neglected to talk about the faux fireplace, the, you know, gas and propane stoves.
That's right. So I asked Sam to hop in the NHPR mobile with me, and we went over to the Stove Barn in Concord, New Hampshire, to see how gas stoves measure up against the wood and pellet variety.
Stove barn.
There's a ton of stoves in here.
There's a lot of stoves.
There's some right here.
This is real. This is real wood stove.
See, this is nice.
Yeah, I could do an interview in front of this all day.
All right. What's this one?
That's a pellet stove.
It's amazing that it can create that much heat given that there's so little burning.
They're pretty cool.
Now the thing that we want to talk about here, because it sort of got neglected in the original segment, is one of the types of stoves that I've always sort of loved and hated, which is the fake wood stove, the gas wood stove.
Why do you hate them?
Well, they're not real.
It's real fire.
Yeah, it's real fire, but like, there's something about it that's like, you can't fool me.
We've got a fake one over here that's not burning.
Okay, let's take a look. So here we've got the Berkeley freestanding gas stove. I mean, it looks exactly like a wood stove, except when you take a closer look at the already burnt fake logs on the inside, there's something slightly suspect about them. What actually is this compared to a normal wood stove?
It's the same in a lot of ways in that it's a box in which combustion could happen. It's just that it's also plumbed with a natural gas or propane supply line so that the fuel is being constantly piped into it from the outside.
But it still produces like a good amount of heat?
Yeah, they produce as much heat as they're willing to, you know, burn gas for, right? So compared to a wood stove where you're controlling how much fuel goes into it, this has like an engineered rate of flow that it's only going to burn that much gas and no more. A wood stove where you've got the whole thing gets hot and it just radiates heat out from all directions, a lot of them have just sort of a blower that's sort of pushing out hot air into the room.
Okay, so aesthetics aside, I mean, in terms of the particular matter that we were talking about for the segment, gas stoves
burn super clean. Natural gas and propane are roughly equivalent in terms of particulate matter that they put out, and it's all 10 times less than the most clean wood stove that you can imagine. In terms of particulate matter, they're much cleaner. The question is that what you're trying to reduce in your heating equipment, right? Like if the thing you're most worried about is particulates, then yeah, you would turn to gas. If you're worried about other things like carbon dioxide because of the global warming potential, then maybe you'd feel a little reticent about using a fossil fuel.
And what about cost for a consumer? I mean, there's like, you know, if you're using gas, then you're paying for that gas. If you're using wood, potentially you're paying for that wood, or maybe you're using your land, so I guess it's a little more variable.
So if you cut your own wood, cordwood's the cheapest, hands down. If you're buying wood, it's still the cheapest, but it's pretty close to natural gas. If you aren't attached to a natural gas network, which here in New Hampshire is most places, you have to use propane. Propane's crazy expensive.
Okay, so bottom line, tell me if I'm getting this right. Better for your health from a particulate matter perspective, not necessarily better for your wallet or better for the environment. In those cases, both potentially worse than a wood stove.
Now you're getting at why it's very hard to separate Yankees from their wood stoves.
Ooh.
That was Sam Evans Brown. He's host of Outside In and producer Taylor Quimby at the Stove Barn. Taylor, I'm not sure any of those who have accused us of being pro-wood stove are going to be convinced otherwise after hearing that little piece.
No, probably not.
Well, more Only in New Hampshire stories coming up, controversial or not, after the break.
Look at that fake fire. Oh my God, look at that fake fire. Okay, I don't even know what this is. That's not. This isn't.
So, good sound effects here.
Yeah, wasn't that good?
Yeah, so some of them they like really clunk into place.
This is Word of Mouth. Your questions answered, your state explored. I'm Virginia Prescott here in the studio with senior producer Taylor Quimby and with producer Ben Henry. Hi, guys.
Hey.
Hello.
So one thing being reinforced with just about every one of our Only in New Hampshire investigations is something we already know. The people of New Hampshire have a real libertarian streak. Not always reflected politically, but philosophically, there is a real sense of fierce independence.
Yeah, and you don't always realize that until you talk to people. But, you know, it's reflected in our laws. We have no income tax, no helmet laws for motorcycles. It's a real core part of our state.
I also think that in New Hampshire, one of the things that you'll find when we're talking about our identity is this need to differentiate ourselves from our neighbors. So part of what New Hampshire is that it is not Vermont, Massachusetts, Maine, or I guess Canada, too.
Or Vermont.
I said Vermont.
Did you? Okay. Just thought you looked over poor little Vermont.
No, no, I just ended with Canada, so you were like, what?
Yeah, it just didn't make sense. So one of these peculiar New Hampshireisms was the focus of an Only in New Hampshire question. That this is one that we got a couple of months ago. Ben, what was it?
So the question we got was, does the lack of a seatbelt law in New Hampshire just create a population of adults who refuse to buckle up? And that was an interesting question to me because there is a factual component. You know, how many people in New Hampshire actually wear their seatbelt compared to elsewhere in the country? And there's a cultural component, which is why, you know, why New Hampshire would rebel against something as straightforward and common sense, frankly, as a seatbelt law.
So to answer this question, you did some research and you and I sat down in a studio to talk it over. So let's go back to that segment. When I was growing up, you know, the drinking age for my older brothers and sisters was 18. My father smoked cigarettes, right?
Or smoking was still good for you.
Still good for you. And we used to ride our bikes without helmets.
You could hitchhike?
Hitchhiking. Oh, my goodness.
Can you
imagine?
You would get in trouble with the
cops. Yep. Imagine kids doing that now.
Airplanes? And no rules for airplanes whatsoever.
you could just walk on.
If you wanted to fly it, you probably could if you asked nicely.
But nowhere in the United States would you be pulled over for not wearing a seatbelt. So when did that change?
Where this starts is in 1984, New York was the first state to pass a law that required everybody to wear their seatbelts. And most other states followed within a couple years. And in a relatively short period of time, we went from no laws on the books to pretty much every state had a law that said, you know, if you're an adult, you have to wear your seatbelt.
How many people were wearing seatbelts back then?
In the early 80s, the numbers that we do have, around 14% of people wore their seatbelts.
Wow.
Which is not very many. So not many people were wearing seatbelts. Within like a decade after all these laws passed, that number was up around 60%, mm-hmm. and today it's around 90%. So we've gone from 14 to 90, which is an incredible change. It, you know, it went from being something that nobody really knew about to now all of a sudden everybody knows that seatbelts save lives. You know, they're incredibly effective. And that's a pretty tremendous shift.
Yeah, and now it's a habit. I mean, I don't know too many people who get in a car, you shut the door, you just click on your seatbelt.
It's not quite universal. There is one state that does not have a law anywhere on the books that requires adults to wear their seatbelts.
Let me guess, New Hampshire.
No law, nothing on the books.
Has that always been true? I mean, did no one ever try and pass a law?
There have been a couple times when the legislature has introduced bills to that effect, and each time they've been shot down. Most recently was 2009. There was a bill introduced into the state house, and it got shot down. You know, everybody agrees that seatbelts are incredibly effective, and you should wear your seatbelt. Nobody really there's no real anti-seatbelt lobby at this point. But people will say it's just not the government's job to make you wear your seatbelt, that this is your own choice. And, you know, we have a right to do risky stuff. And, you know, New Hampshire has a libertarian streak. We just decided, you know, we don't want that law. As a result of never having one of these laws, people in the state do not wear their seatbelt as much as people in other states. Fewer people in New Hampshire wear their seatbelt, in fact, than any other state.
So what percentage are we talking about?
The national average is 90% of people wear their seatbelt. In New Hampshire, it's 70% of people. So it's still a solid majority, but substantially fewer people here. And, you know, 2009 was the last time we really had this public discussion. And I wanted to know how people felt about it now. Do people still feel strongly that the government shouldn't be in the business of telling people, you know, to buckle their seatbelts? So I spent an afternoon in Concord, walking around, hanging out in a parking lot, and asking people. Do you wear your seatbelt?
Of course.
All the time?
Yeah.
Why is that?
I don't know. Habit? Safety?
Okay.
We wear ours all the time. We taught our kids to do that, even when they were little. And they still put their seatbelts on all the time. I think it's just a wise measure, you know, for your own safety.
I wear it every day, all the time.
All the time?
Yes, just because I have grandchildren and they watch what I do.
Yeah. Do you guys wear your seatbelts?
Yes.
You both wear your seatbelts all the time?
My car beeps at me if I don't, so yeah.
Fair enough.
Mine doesn't beep and I still wear it.
You're shaking your head. You don't wear your seatbelt. Why is that?
Laziness. It's very hard to get it pulled around. It's hard to get it to click in. And it's worse to try to get it off.
When my grandchildren aren't in the car, I don't sometimes.
Okay.
I'm a rebel.
Well, I never liked wearing them. I was in a wreck one time, and my sister was driving. The car was totaled, and we didn't even get a bruise or a scratch.
Were you wearing your seatbelt?
No.
You might know New Hampshire is the only state in the whole country where it's not legally required that you wear your seatbelt. You can't get a ticket for it. What do you think about that?
I think it's fine. I think that, you know, state motto and all.
The state motto being?
Live free or die.
I think children should be required to do it, but as adults, I mean, they're adults and they should, you know, it's their own decision to make.
New Hampshire does have that reputation for being the live free or die state, you know.
I think it would be up to the individual person. Mm-hmm. I don't think it should be mandatory.
Mm-hmm. So you would probably oppose a seatbelt law?
Yeah, probably, yeah.
Okay.
Live free or die, man. Just the way it is. And if you're foolish enough not to wear seatbelts or not wear helmets, it's all up to you.
I'm okay with it being a personal choice, but if they did make it a law, it wouldn't bother me since it's what I practice anyways. So. I mean, would I be marching in front of the state house in protest of a law that said that you should have to wear your seatbelt? No. But, you know, if it was a ballot item, would I say that people have to wear their seatbelt? No, I wouldn't. I would vote that down.
Well, it's interesting that you say you kind of want that to be your prerogative to tell your children how, you know, what's safe and what's not safe, but not necessarily the government's job.
Exactly.
Okay, fair enough. Thank you for sharing. I really appreciate it. Yeah, have a good day.
Oftentimes when people do things for their own good, they're wagging their fingers at other people who aren't. And I didn't hear that. What I heard here is, no, I use my seatbelt all the time, but I don't think it should be a law.
Yeah. You know, it's a pretty fundamental question about what role the government should play in our lives, whether, you know, when you have something like this that we all know it's a good idea and there's no reason not to wear your seatbelt, there's still a question of whether or not the government should be in the business of enforcing that kind of common sense rule. And I heard the state motto a lot. I think it's very familiar and, you know, it's powerful. For one thing, it's a dramatic phrase, right? Live free or die. It's an ultimatum. I think just because we grow up seeing it everywhere and people really internalize that and, you know, when you have to answer, you know, big, important questions, it's really helpful to have a sweeping motto like that that seems to encapsulate everything and to answer every question in the same way.
So what I'm wondering is, do New Hampshire's looser seatbelt laws and correspondingly all those unbuckled drivers, does that lead to more injuries and fatalities?
That's a good question, and I looked into that, and the answer is no, not really. Traffic fatalities in New Hampshire are actually below the national average.
Huh. Well, any idea why?
That's another good question, and to answer it, I had to call in some backup. I talked to Russ Rader at the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety, which is a nonprofit that does research on traffic fatalities. And I asked him that exact question. Given that people in New Hampshire don't buckle up as much, why don't we have higher fatalities compared to other states?
When you look at fatality rates state by state, you see the highest rates tend to be in the Midwest and West, where you have fewer urban areas, greater expanses of distances on more dangerous two-lane high-speed rural roads. You don't have those vast expanses of space in New Hampshire. And your population density tends to be concentrated in the southern half of the state near urban areas. So the roads are less hazardous in New Hampshire than they are in many other states.
So, Russ, I've been talking with residents here about this exact problem. And there have been times in the past where we introduced bills that would require people to wear their seatbelts. A lot of people say, you know, it just shouldn't be the government's job to make people wear their seatbelts. I'm curious what you think about that.
Well, it works. And, you know, the motto, live free or die may be ingrained in the culture of New Hampshire, but people are dying needlessly because of lack of belt use. And we could be saving a lot of lives if people were required to buckle up.
Okay, Ben, do you use your seatbelt? Ooh, long pause. I think we have our answer.
I do wear my seatbelt all the time.
Every time. Okay. Thank you so much for your work on this.
You are welcome.
I'm Virginia Prescott, and this is Word of Mouth. Your questions answered, your state explored. So we aired that conversation just a couple of weeks ago. Ben, how did people react?
We got a lot of comments online that were of the libertarian nature. There were a lot of anti-seatbelt comments, in part because I think that's just a cause that people get fired up about online. But we also had some people weighing in on the other side of the argument. There were a lot of people who said, we should have laws making seatbelts mandatory for drivers. And there were a couple things that people brought up that we didn't get into in that story that we just heard. One issue was brought up by listener Weldon, and he brought up the topic of health insurance. Because if you are not wearing your seatbelt and you get into an accident and then you go to the hospital to get treated for, you know, getting banged up in that accident, the cost of that treatment gets translated onto the health insurance market. And so we all end up paying for this person's recklessness. So in a way, not wearing your seatbelt can affect other people. Another listener, Larian, brought up another issue, which is federal funding. By not having a seatbelt law, New Hampshire actually loses out on some funding from the federal government on the order of a couple million dollars.
For highway building, I think, or something like that?
Exactly. Yeah, this came up the last time we talked about whether or not we should have this law, because that's a reason that politicians want to pass that kind of law, because we would get, you know, some money. And this comment sparked a whole thread about New Hampshire and our roads, and people saying we don't need the federal government to pay for our roads. We do a fine job on our own. Our roads are great. Just look at Massachusetts. The roads suck. We're better than Massachusetts. So it kind of got out of hand.
Always comes back to comparing to Massachusetts.
There you go. Taylor was right. We're always distinguished from the Massachusetts people.
Oh, that was close. I know what you were going for there.
Another thing that came out in the comments section was something that I also heard on the street, which is that a lot of people wear their seatbelt just because their cars beep at them incessantly and very irritatingly.
That would drive me insane.
We all know what this sounds like. It's terrible. My car does it. Honestly, if it didn't do it, I probably would wear my seatbelt less.
So for people that are really against wearing their seatbelts, I mean, I wonder how they get past that, because presumably they're not just like sitting there listening to the beeping thinking this beeping is worth my freedom.
Wearing earplugs?
There's that, and there's also a whole internet rabbit hole about the ways that people work around this, and a whole cottage industry of gadgets that allow you to work around that exact problem.
Mm, of course.
For under $10, you can get a little gizmo that's basically just a unattached seatbelt buckle, just a metal loop, and you're sitting there, and you just buckle it in your car, being pretty dumb. Your car just thinks that you're buckled in.
This reminds me of people who have their cars modified so that they break emissions laws so that they can, because there's this whole thing, I forget what it's called, but basically there's people who have like diesel trucks and they'll press a button and they'll blow out a big plume of smoke. And
I've
it's totally
it
illegal. You have to get your car modified from, you know, the sort of legal manufacturer's settings to be able to do this. And people will do it sort of for whatever reason. I'm not sure. I mean, I guess it's just a sort of rebellion thing.
Well, that is the next step on this rabbit hole. If you don't want to buy one of these gadgets, if you want to get really serious about not having to wear your seatbelt, you can go in there and modify your car. And the easiest way to do this is in some cars, it's like they make it really easy. You can like do it right on the dashboard, or you can do bizarre things like buckle and unbuckle your seatbelt like 20 times in 30 seconds. You know, just kind of there's some hand waving involved.
It's like a video
right
game.
So sometimes some cars make it easy, and some cars have things in the manual that will tell you how to do this. If you don't have one of those cars, then you have to break out your toolkit and kind of get under the seat and start opening things up. And
do mechanics ever get asked to do this kind of stuff?
Yeah, I wanted to know if people around here in New Hampshire do ask their mechanics to do this. I called up Midas in Concord, and I talked to a guy named Don. So I'm just wondering, do you guys get people coming into your shop asking to disable the beeping in their car when their seatbelt isn't buckled?
Actually, I can't remember the last time we had somebody request that, no.
Huh, okay. How long have you been working at Midas?
I've been here a little over 4 years.
Okay, and it's just not something you've heard of somebody coming in and asking?
No, honestly, I can't remember anybody asking that since I've been here.
Do you know how to do it?
No.
Huh, okay. Any idea, like, if
I
it's...
I didn't think you could do it, but...
Oh, okay, you didn't.
Suppose anything's possible.
I feel like I need to interject and say, as senior producer, I'm for wearing your seatbelt rather than spending money on a seatbelt beeping fake thing. So.
I mean, it is really interesting that you would bother to put a fake thing in your seatbelt but wouldn't wear one.
Yeah, a part of me admires the tenacity here. Another part of me has read the fatality analysis statistics, and I can tell you if more people here wore their seatbelts, lives would be saved, and that's just how it is.
Thanks, Ben.
You are welcome.
Don't forget that all of the segments that we played today were generated by listeners just like you. You can send our producers out to investigate questions for our Only in New Hampshire series by submitting your own at wordofmouthradio.org or on nhpr.org. This episode was produced by Taylor Quimby and Ben Henry with Jimmy Gutierrez and Hannah McCarthy. Maureen McMurray is director of the public radio Steely Dan Fan Club. Really hurts me to say that. Music in this episode from Poddington Bear, Blue Dot Sessions, and Brooke for Free. I'm Virginia Prescott. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR.